to America.
This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. Tammy and Cheryl are here to answer the phones and to man the computers. Our guest tonight is Mike Gray, author of Drug Crazy and script writer of The China Syndrome, and a producer and director of various movies and television productions you've enjoyed through the years. We'll also hear from the Big Green Machine, who will come here and play a couple of songs for us and tell us about the upcoming 420 music and cannabis odyssey to be held on Easter Sunday up and down Washington Avenue. But first, a little bit of news. A very important case that could impact the overall mechanism of the drug war has been going on in Tulia, Texas. The lone Coleman, one Tom Coleman, is in an evidentiary hearing which has proven that this undercover agent who arrested 10% of a small town's black population on drug charges we'll get into what he was here in a minute. Coleman conducted a one-man sting operation that led to the arrest of 40 black people, with many sentenced to lengthy jail terms, including terms of 60, 99, and 434 years. This is for possession of cocaine, my friends. Four defendants have challenged their convictions, and in hearings, law enforcement officials from Tulia and neighboring towns testified that Coleman's police work was worthless. One described Coleman as a paranoid gun nut, and another called him a racist. Coleman conceded some of his testimony in the cases might be an error, but said he was a regular, normal human being, a Texan. Here in Texas, more scandals have hit the fan in regards to the drug lab. That wasn't a lab at all. The police chief has asked that their data be taken from the national database because of the failure to properly test, track, and store data. The DNA, ballistics, and now drug tests have been shown to be nothing more than a rubber stamp for whatever the DA wanted them to say. Let's remember that the war of terror is nothing new. This war began decades before 9-1-1. It's all up and down the Americas. In Bolivia, the police are shooting the children of the cocaleros, the growers of the coca plants. Thousands upon thousands of deaths occur each year for these chemical weapons. Paramilitary with automatic weapons stormed the premises from South America to the Canadian border. Last year alone, 8,000 people were killed in just Colombia alone. Those who were killed were not drug barons or smugglers of tons of cocaine, but were predominantly poor coca farmers or even villagers who were just on lands much desired by Chevron, Occidental, or Exxon. The war of terror is not about drugs or even Osama bin Laden. I think this war is about oil, certainly, but it is really about total world power. The war of terror is meant to last forever, just like the drug war. So now we have these sequential wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with our almost certain repercussions of reciprocal terror and therefore long-term implications for additional wars. And let's take a short break, and we'll be back with the sounds of Green Machine. Okay. Yes, what if God did smoke cannabis? Well, he'd probably come to the 420 festival, I think, is the first thing he'd do. It's the Christian thing to do, folks. And we are lucky to have Big Green Machine in here. They're going to sing us a song in a minute. But tell us, what is this all about?
The 420 festival is about pretty much people getting together and having a nice time enjoying the greenery, meaning the Big Green Machine and all the other bands on and everything.
48 bands, am I right?
48 bands.
48
on.
Bands, five venues, or is it six? I mean, we've got stages, and it costs $8. The proceeds go to Houston Normal.
All up and down Washington Avenue.
It's going to be a great event. I want to ask you, you know, this is, it tends to draw a lot of girls. I heard 80%, is that right?
Yeah. Chad, you want to have some...
Well,
input on
I
that.
I know about the 420 Fest, but I know that our shows,
yeah,
about 80%.
And I think at the 420 Fest, we're going to try and up the percentages. So,
hey, Alex, tell us some of these bands we're going to have.
Well, we got Big Green Machine. Also want to let you know, everybody, that they've donated a 1976 Viper Ovation electric guitar.
It's beautiful, my friends.
By the Green Machine. Only like 1 of 1,000 made. Might get signed by a famous rock star, but either way, it's an incredible collector's item, and that's just one of the reasons to come down there and support Normal. We're also, let's not forget about supporting the local scene, all the other great bands, Oscar O'Bear and the Las Vegas Connection, one of my favorite drummers in the world, Lisa Harrington. She's playing with Jimmy's Pawn Shop over at Silky's. New Damage is on the 420 Normal stage right before Big Green Machine plays out there. Felix Madison, which you guys have over here all the time.
And one of my favorite bands, Irene, is also going to be on the Normal stage.
Oh, yeah.
You guys got them.
Right after Big Machine is Big a Fig is. You can't get any hotter than that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, guys, did you have a song you wanted to play for us?
Sure. This song is off our upcoming album. I think it's going to be called, maybe the audience could call it and pick for us. We're either going to call it Heavy Mellow or Devil's Lettuce. And I think we all know what we're talking about when we're talking about the devil's lettuce.
We let her rip.
But this song's called Allison. It's about the flood.
Can't stand the half of this I see. I
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Alex. Yes.
Giancarlo isn't here tonight. Our bass player is out playing, actually, at Brian O'Neill's tonight. So it's just Chad Lyons and myself, Alex.
Oh, y'all two folks did a fine job. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, they need a new bass player, too.
Right. I'd like to thank you guys, for having us out here. In the Houston
you bet.
Alliance.
No, thank you guys for the donation of this wonderful guitar. Folks, you got to come out and take a look at that guitar.
People 420,
Easter afternoon, 3 to midnight, 6 bands. Six venues, 48 bands.
After you get done hanging out, doing the family thing, there's plenty of time to come out, do your Easter egg hunt, and then come out and hunt down the fun at the festival.
And I, you know, as always, Normal encourages you not to bring any drugs. And one thing I've got to say is, for God's sake, do not share with people you do not know. Last year, the police, you know, in this time of great terror, sent 22 officers to our festival trying to bust people. Do not share with anyone you do not know.
Except the big green machine.
Find the promoters of the event. Come and talk to him. His name is Alex Lozano. He's a pretty cool guy. Come and talk to him and
share
smoke,
with him.
Share with me. Right.
Okay, all right, gentlemen, you got time for one more quick song. What you got for us?
Song's called Two Pump Chump. It's about keeping it down when you're up. Fest, we're going to light it up electric style for you.
I want to tell you something. I have been in probably 100, 150 hearings like this at various times in my political career. And the story is always the same. This goes all the way back to the 60s. you know, 35, 40 years ago. But there's no end to it. Over 70% of all crime is drug-related, and you've alluded to that today. We saw on television recently Pablo Escobar gunned down, and everybody applauded that and said, that's the end of the Medellin cartel. But it wasn't the end. Yeah, there's still a cartel down there. They're still all over the place. When you kill one, there's 10 or 20 or 50 waiting to take his place. There's always going to be another person in line to make that money. And we go into drug eradication, and we go into rehabilitation, and we go into education, and we do all these things. And the drug problem continues to increase, and it continues to cost us not billions, but trillions of dollars. Trillions! And we continue to build more and more prisons, and we put more and more people in jail, and we know that the crimes that they're committing are related most of the time to drugs. And I don't think they'd be refining coca and heroin in Colombia if they couldn't make any money. And I don't think that Al Capone would have been the menace to society that he was if he couldn't sell alcohol on the black market. And he did. And we had a horrible, horrible crime problem.
We want to bring in our guest, Mike Gray. Mike, can you hear me?
I can, Dean. How are you?
I'm well, sir. It's good
was
to hear you.
Was that the famous senator from Indiana there that we were just listening to?
I'm not sure what state he's from. Bob Burton, the head of the Congressional Committee on Colombian Cocaine or something, the retiring head who just, he retired, I guess, 2-3 months ago. And that was his farewell speech, his the farewell scene from the end of Traffic, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He dared to almost say the word legalize that day.
I had read the speech that Burton is from Indiana. Incidentally, it was his kid that got busted for growing 37 plants in Indianapolis, and he got probation, of course. I mean, he's a senator's son, so then he got busted again. He had a trunk load of marijuana, I think, and so you know. Burton has, I guess you'd have to say, direct experience with the drug problem.
Sure, sure. Sometimes reality will bring home the truth to you like that.
Well, it was amazing listening to him to come off it like that because he's been such a rabid drug warrior all his life. And for him to finally, you know, in the 11th hour after he's leaving, of course, and can't do anything about it, he comes finally to the conclusion that we've all had all along, which is this war is unwinnable.
Right. I must agree. He's... you know, I think we ran into the second track. We'll play that here in a minute, where he talks a kind of a two segments. One is, you know, just the second one's more about what if we legalize. The first was talking about all the headache and hassle, $1 trillion, etc. You know, Mike, this world is getting to be crazier every day, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the drug war was bad enough, and now we're headed into this. I call it the war of terror, you know, is nothing more than the war on drugs with an afterburner.
Yep.
And I just don't quite understand why the American people can't grasp what's going on in the, you know, halls of Washington.
Yeah. it is an amazing time in history. I never imagined we'd see anything quite like this, but here we are.
Yes. Micah, you know, I understand that you've written another book. Has it been published?
Right. It was published by Nation Books. I didn't actually write the book. It's a collection. It's called Busted.
Uh-huh.
It's published by The Nation, and it's available on Amazon.com and most bookstores. And it's an anthology of recent drug war writings. It's just basically... A bunch of, you know, there's, for example, there is an interview with Manuel Noriega in prison with Oliver Stone.
Wow.
And it's really fascinating. It was from The Atlantic, I think. It's all just, you know, like most of the articles have been written within the last 36 months, and they go all the way across the spectrum, left of, you know, absolute, you know, radical position to Christopher Hitchens to Bill Buckley, you know, on the extreme right.
Right.
And all extremely critical of the drug war. And it's a fairly devastating indictment when you consider all these different people coming at it from all these different angles. And, you know, a lot of them are personal stories that there's this fascinating story that lengthy article that... ran, I think, in the New Yorker about the inside where inner workings of a narco informant working the Mexican border. It's really scary. You know, it's basically, but the bottom line is when you get done with it, you know, it's, as some one of the reviewers said, they couldn't imagine a more damning indictment of the drug war than coming at it from all these different angles.
I understand. Mike, your book, Drug Crazy, How We Got Into This Mess and How We Can Get Out, is a wonderful book. I've been reading back through it this past week. And, you know, there's a passage near the end of the book there where you're calling it pretty good in that the federal government trying to, I don't know, lean a little harder, bring back the 19th century superstition and quash the marijuana movement.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, well, it's not, like you said, I predicted it in the book. There's that passage in the book that that refers to the medical marijuana war that's now being waged here in California. And the federal government's come down like a ton of bricks on medical. They busted a little old lady up in Mendocino County for six plants. A federal bust. I mean, used to be, before Bush, the Bush administration took over, the federal government basically said, you know, anything less than 1,000 plants, we're not interested in. That's a state matter. You know, we only handle the big stuff. Now the feds are saying we handle one plant. And what they're trying to do, quite clearly, is to crush the medical marijuana movement here in California, because they figure this is where it all began. This is where it started with Proposition 215 back in 1996. That passed by voter initiative by overwhelmingly, the California voters passed this initiative saying that medical marijuana patients who have a doctor's recommendation should be able to grow their own marijuana or have marijuana and possess it and use it. And so the feds figure they've got to wipe this out. They cannot allow this to happen. And the issue is not whether marijuana is medicine or not. The issue is the whole drug war, which they quite clearly and correctly, I think, see is at stake. And this is what I wrote about this back in 1997, shortly after Proposition 215 was passed here in California. And it says, just let me, bear with me, I'll read this, just two paragraphs here.
All right, go ahead.
If California survives this apostasy, other states will follow. Some will enact stringent rules, while others may experiment once again with broader decriminalization. When a national consensus finally forms on this issue, it's almost certain to come down in favor of the sick and dying, because they make much more convincing TV commercials than men in suits. At that point, the majority of U.S. citizens will be in opposition to their own government's policy, and something will have to give. The coming engagement promises to be bloody, because the outcome of the whole war is at stake. Prohibition as policy can only ratchet in one direction. Each failure must be met with more repression. Any step backward calls into question the fundamental assumption that repression is going to be the answer. Ultimately, every available gun will be brought to bear, because marijuana is the pawl on the ratchet, that little catch that keeps the drum from unwinding. For 60 years, Harry Anslinger and his successors have put their backs to this wheel, laboring to hoist drug prohibition to the level of a national crusade. But if somebody jiggles that pawl and the drum slips, support for current policy will plummet like a loose cage in a mine shaft, because it cannot sustain a serious evaluation. So basically what we're looking at here is could turn out to be one of the defining battles of the whole drug war, and it's taking place in California right now. So we're trying to muster attention and resources to combat this onslaught, and the feds have just gone. I mean, they've gone over the top. Their behavior has been just.
Well, Ashcroft with his bong bust, World Wide Web. He said they were hiding in the open. I'm not sure exactly how he phrased it, but
yeah, basically. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, like they really. The extent to which they are maneuvering here in the federal courts is really breathtaking. They arrested a guy named Brian Eppes, who was a Good Samaritan, basically growing up in Chico, California, under the guidelines of the California Initiative 215. He was growing for himself. He was in a car accident, has a fused spine, and is in excruciating pain, and he uses marijuana, says it relieves his pain. he and these other people all had doctor's recommendations for the use of marijuana for a variety of diseases, MS, one thing and another. And he was busted by the feds, hauled into court, and they would not allow his lawyer or him or anybody or any of his witnesses to even mention the words medical marijuana.
Well,
he could present no defense whatsoever. Eppes was presented to the jury as a drug kingpin.
Without the legitimacy of the medical marijuana to...
No.
I heard just yesterday, I think Scott Imler, the Los Angeles
Los Angeles Cannabis Resource Center. Yeah, Scott pled guilty because he had no choice. He was looking at a possible 20 years. So he's hoping that they'll... Scott Imler, his operation, they served 960 patients here in West Hollywood. A lot of these people were terminally ill. One of the executives on the board of directors, I know, I videotaped an interview with her, and she was dead 3 weeks later. So we're not talking about people who were sitting around smoking pot to get high.
No.
People who were desperately, desperately ill.
I've talked with Scott. I've read the information. He's a gentle soul. He's a person with compassion, unlike Bush, who says he has. Let me interrupt here 1 second. Mike, I want to alert the listeners out there. We will be taking your calls here in a few minutes. Our number here, 713-526-5738. I want to tell you you're listening to Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth on KPFT Houston and on the Sirius Radio Network, Channel 147. And we're now in Galveston at 89.5 FM. Our special guest is Mike Gray, author of Drug Crazy, How We Got Into This Mess, and How We Can Get Out. That's available online at drugcrazy.com. And Mike, tell us about some of the other, productions you've been involved with.
One thing I wanted to talk about right here while we're talking about the Bryant.
Sure, go ahead.
I think the federal government overreached themselves in the latest trial here. I think they got their hands burned very badly. That doesn't mean they're going to slow down at all, but they arrested Ed Rosenthal, I think by mistake. Ed Rosenthal is a grandfatherly figure who's very well known and respected and loved in the Bay Area up in Oakland, and he's a writer. He's written a number of books about marijuana and other subjects.
Another gentle
columnist, and he's an authority on horticulture and orchids and other things like that. And the city of Oakland deputized him to grow marijuana for the city of Oakland. Okay?
Yes.
And they provided him, and they got a warehouse in downtown Oakland that the fire department inspected to make sure that the wiring was up to snuff. And, everybody went through the health department. Everybody approved all of this. It was all totally up and up, and at the behest of the city of Oakland. And they designated him a city official to provide medical marijuana to the various patients in Oakland. So the feds, when Asa Hutchinson was just appointed head of the DEA, remember, he's left now. He resigned and went on to bigger and better things in Homeland Security. But he was appointed by Bush to head the Drug Enforcement Administration a year and a half ago. And when he came to San Francisco, he was to address the Commonwealth Club, which is old money, you know. I mean, this is where the chips are.
Sure.
The Commonwealth Club is, this is the creme de la creme of San Francisco. So Asa Hutchinson, he doesn't know any better. He's from Arkansas. What does he know? He assumes that these guys are all, big money. They're all obviously Republicans.
Yes.
And clearly in support of his program and so forth. So he's making his first appearance on the West Coast, and he triumphantly announces before the Commonwealth Club that his agents have just busted Ed Rosenthal. And instead of the standing ovation he anticipated, he was practically booed out of the building. I mean, people were outraged, you know.
Well, sure.
By then, the fat was in the fire. They had busted him, so they had to bring him to trial. And listen to what happened at the trial. This was about 6 weeks ago.
Yes.
They brought him to the trial, concluded, and once again, as in the Eppes case, the judge refused to allow any mention of medical marijuana, would not allow the city officials who had deputized Rosenthal to testify on his behalf or even to testify at all. They wouldn't allow him to have any witnesses. Once again, they presented him as a drug kingpin to the jury, okay?
Sure.
An absolutely outrageous performance. And so... When the jury convicted him, they didn't have much choice. They were instructed to by the judge. The judge says, convict him. You know, you can't let your conscience. They were suspicious because the trial had proceeded in such a strange way. You know, every time somebody wanted to speak on behalf of the defense, the judge ruled it out of order. So they were a little spooked about this thing, but the judge said, you know, you can't. His actual quote was, you cannot substitute your sense of justice for your duty to follow the law. And so they submerged their sense of justice and convicted him.
Oh,
he's facing a mandatory 5 to 20 year sentence.
Gosh.
Okay?
Yes.
But when the jurors walked out of the building, there were some young ladies there from an organization called Americans for Safe Access. And they explained to the jurors who Ed Rosenthal was. And the jurors had a fit right there on the courthouse steps. And they had a press conference on that very spot the following day demanding a new trial.
The jurors.
I mean, it's...
I understand some of those jurors actually voted for Prop 215.
This one juror says, Marnie Craig, she says, I couldn't believe that I had been part of such a travesty of justice. He was growing medical marijuana to give to sick people and losing money on the whole proposition, and we convicted him as a criminal. And fellow juror says, I felt like I couldn't even walk down the street among, you know, other Americans without feeling like I had just wronged everyone. And the jury foreman himself said, I felt conned. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, and this was on CNN, it was all over the network news. And so I think that this is going to prove to be a turning point in the whole drug war here, because ultimately I think what's going to happen is the federal government will not be able to get a conviction.
Right. They won't find a panel of jurors that will stand for it.
I mean, they find, you know, all it takes is one juror.
Right.
I don't care what you say. And this is something that that I don't think, in other words, the jurors were misinformed.
Well, they were lied to. Yes,
yeah,
you bet.
Well, they were lied to. And but I mean, this is something that all American citizens, when called for jury duty, should remember. When you are in that jury room, you outrank the judge and everybody else. The judge, the prosecutor, you don't have to answer to anyone.
But your conscience
and
your sense of justice.
Absolutely.
You bet. Mike, we are getting a lot of callers. You want to go ahead and field some of these?
Absolutely. Let's talk to the folks.
We have Javier on line one. You hear us, Javier?
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well, sir. Do you have a question for Mike Gray?
Yes, I do. I don't know, has he heard anything about, I've been hearing little tidbits about this, about an operation led by Ashcroft called Operation Pipe Dreams?
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of friends who seem to be involved in that kind of business, and I'm afraid that it's going to affect them, and they're going to get thrown into jail. And is there any legal basis for these arrests and these raids they're conducting on these people who blow pipes and that sort of thing?
Well, technically, I mean, if we had an actual Supreme Court and a real, you know, if they really, you know, like cared anything about the Constitution, these laws would not exist, because basically a pipe is a pipe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can say, well, this is a marijuana pipe and that's a coke pipe and that's a, you know, the pipe is a pipe. You can use a tobacco pipe for marijuana if you wish to, and conversely.
Yeah.
This is a bizarre, what this is about, this is a cultural war. Okay?
Yeah.
And these guys, it's fairly clear now that what Ashcroft and the people in the Bush Justice Department are up to, you know, they want to. Somebody said it's 1984. 1954. That's what they're after. They want to erase the 60s. They want to pretend like Vietnam,
yes,
and the 60s and the hippies and you and I never existed. That whole countercultural movement was just simply a pipe dream and it never really happened. And if they can stamp out marijuana, they figure that they'll make a move in this cultural war that will allow them to keep liquor supreme or whatever.
Yeah, because honestly, I don't see them busting down the door to tobacco shops and busting owners who sell things like corn pipes and wooden pipes like that. So I was just kind of wondering about that.
Well, it's totally, it's obviously unconstitutional, and yet the Supreme Court says it's not. And, you know, the Supreme Court is who it is. I mean, they, you know, those guys have pretty much rebuilt the Constitution on their own watch there. I also did a book about the death penalty, by the way, and I was intrigued by the fact that Justice Antonin Scalia said at one point that actual innocence really doesn't make any difference as far as the death penalty is concerned. The main thing, the main question is, did you have a fair trial? And, you know, and if all the procedures were followed properly, the fact that you may not have committed the crime is really irrelevant. Your execution must proceed. So these are guys who are, you know, I mean, it's a triumph of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. They're only interested in the repressive aspects of the law.
Aren't they, though? Javier, thank you so much. We're going to go to our next caller. The man both of us, I'm sure, respect, Mike, Richard Lake.
Richard.
Hi, how are you doing, Mike?
All right, Richard, wonderful. Richard Lake is one of the heroes of the drug reform movement, a man who coordinates a huge enterprise there. Tell him about it, Richard.
Oh, well, not a lot to tell. I think most of the listeners know about www.mapinc.org.
It's MAPINC.org, folks. It's a great place to visit.
Yeah, it's one of the best resources on the net.
You betcha.
We're an enabling organization. Bad enablers. We enable activists in every way we can think of. That's what we're all about.
Very good.
Just got 100,000 news clippings. Just passed that milestone and got a huge pile of letters from various activists and reformers, which the volunteers.
Yeah.
And it is mostly volunteers that do all the work to make it happen. That's what I talk about enabling. We enable some folks living in small towns to, in the middle of an out in farms, to sit there and be active where, you know, where they can't join those big doings in Houston, but they can still be active over the net and have a real impact.
Right.
Mike, I certainly agree with you that unlike Brian's case, I think they bit off more than they could chew with Ed Rosenthal. I saw op-eds and editorials way outside of California that were not too kind to the administration in that case.
Well, it puts them in a very bad light because, I mean, let's face it, when they're attack on medical marijuana, it's guys in ninja suits versus little old ladies in wheelchairs. That's a bad image for the federal government.
Certainly is. But right now we're seeing a situation where, because of our war over in Iraq, we're seeing some of our news being pushed off the pages. Number of news items has dropped a little bit, and you know, that's something we have to deal with. Of course, in time that'll pick back up. But wanted to ask you, are you going to make it to the normal conference?
I am going to be there. I'm actually supposed to be on a panel in San Francisco, Richard.
Good.
On Thursday, I think. But
yeah, Matt Elrod,
maybe, I don't know.
Matt Elrod and Dick Cohen and bunch of others that are in the news field, Dave Borden, are going to be on a panel on Thursday and on Sunday. And people keep, a lot of people I don't think really are looking at the Sunday schedule. Sunday is a workshop aimed at student activists, but really good for any activist, a full day of workshops. Basically two workshops at a time. One of them is going to be with Robert Sharp, who is the world's most published letter to the editor writer, I believe. Belongs in the Guinness Book, I think. You know, I haven't checked the last
990 or something, isn't it?
It's up there. It's past 800 somewhere.
It's a buzz.
And opposite that is going to be Matt Elrod and Doug Snead and myself on how groups like Normal Chapters and and Students for Sensible Drug Policy chapters can get a web presence, email list, use the net to their advantage to gain members and put the message they need want to put out. So that's on Sunday, and I hope people are looking at that Sunday schedule and not thinking Sunday is that it's not going on Sunday, because I think Sunday is going to be very interesting.
Well, Richard,
I think grassroots organizing is tremendously important. I think you know, this is the moment where that's really going to pay off. So I'm glad to see this is happening.
Well, Richard, this year I've been unemployed for 7 months. I'm trying to scrape up enough cash to get out there because it's a wonderful place for me to get interviews for my radio shows. I'm hoping to do it. We do have some other callers. I thank you so much, Richard.
Okay, thank you.
I hope to talk with you again here real soon.
Yeah, be looking, hoping we see you out there in San Francisco.
You betcha. Okay, Richard, thank you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's go to Tom on line three.
Hi there.
Hello, Tom.
I got a statement, but we can turn into a question.
All right.
The statement is, I believe we're going to go through what we're going through for the next 20 years because voters of America will only vote for a lawyer, for senator, congressman, or president. They'll only vote for a lawyer who is a Republican or a Democrat. They won't vote for anyone else.
Well,
we keep getting the same
well,
old.
Well, I think I can understand where you're coming from, and I know that it looks very bleak with both the Republicans and the Democrats being sufficiently incompetent and cowardly, I must say.
Yes, cowards.
But I think we can push this through. Here's the thing. 80% of the American people believe, for example, I mean, medical marijuana is the salient issue, and it's where I am directing 100% of my energies right now to the battle here in California, because I think if we turn Ashcroft here in California, we can stop. I think this is a pivotal moment in the drug war. Precisely because of what I was saying earlier, the image is totally in our favor. You've got federal agents in ninja suits cracking little old ladies in wheelchairs. They literally handcuffed an MS patient, a paraplegic MS patient, to her bed.
Because she couldn't
stand up. Took her crutches away while they ripped up the plants. And, you know, that kind of stuff does not go down well. I mean, people were outraged, sufficiently outraged. This happened up in Santa Cruz, that the city council of Santa Cruz, with the blessing of the sheriff and the chief of police, handed out medical marijuana to patients in City Hall the following weekend. So, you know, this is beginning to grind on a lot of people. They're very tired of this guy and his posturing and covering up the statue of justice with a drape, I think, is not only symbolic, it's highly indicative of where this guy is at.
Yes.
Yeah, but the Republicans and the Democrats will still keep the same bureaucracies going over and over again, and bureaucracies do nothing but grow bigger. They don't shrink.
Right, but we did end Prohibition, and Prohibition, you'll have to remember, was an even tougher nut to crack because it was a constitutional amendment. What finally cracked it was when the parents realized that their kids were not better off. They were much, much worse off with the under Prohibition than they ever had been. I never forget the statement by Pauline Sabin, who was, I credit, with ending alcohol prohibition. She didn't end it by herself, obviously, but she administered the coup de grace in a speech to the House Ways and Means Committee. She was one of the first actual powerful women political figures in the country. They had just gotten the vote, you know, not too long before that. And she was addressing the House Committee on February the 13th, 1930. Right as Prohibition was really coming to an end. And she said, I thought, like all women, that a world without alcohol would be a beautiful world, and I supported Prohibition and so forth. And she says, but we have come to realize, with heart burning and heart aching, that in our attempt to make Prohibition as strong as the Constitution, we have made the Constitution as weak as Prohibition.
Oh,
she said, before Prohibition, my children had no access to alcohol. Now they can get it anywhere.
Yeah, because it costs more.
The reason that high school kids today say it's easier to get marijuana than to get beer is because beer is controlled by the state.
Yeah. How long did Prohibition go from beginning to end? 10 years?
It started in 1919. Actually, it went into effect the following year. And it was ended 13 years later, in 1933.
Well, our drug war has been going on much longer than that.
Well, the drug war was parallel. In other words, it was the ramping up to the drug to alcohol prohibition that created the environment for the drug war, and the drug war began at the same time. Actually, they both really began in 1914. Mm-hmm. If you look at it. In other words, they banned beer production in 1914 because of the war effort, supposedly.
Tom, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we do have a couple more callers, and I wanted to have a chance to get to them. Tom, I wanted to throw in one point.
Yeah.
There are some very responsible, legitimate people that are going to be running for office in this country, and one that I can think of, I think, is going to run for president under Libertarian is Judge James P. Gray.
Yeah.
And he's got my vote, you betcha.
I appreciate it.
All right, Tom, thank you so much. Let's go ahead and pick up John, line four.
Hello there. Hello.
Hey, hello, John. You have a question for Mike Gray.
Yes. Mike, how you doing?
Hi, John.
It's great to hear from you. I admire you for a long time. I've joined late here, and I just wonder, have you all mentioned Canada this evening?
We have not.
Okay. Canada seems to be really turning, and they've already got nationally medical marijuana, and I just wondered, what do you think would happen if they went all the way? I mean, could we resist that example right there on our northern border there?
Well, it's driving the Bush administration cuckoo because, Chrétien is not particularly fond of George Bush anyway. Canadians, you'll notice, refuse to be part of the so-called coalition of the willing.
Listen,
they're not
the cow.
Huh?
Cow, C-O-W.
Right. they sent John Walters up there, the drug czar up there, to warn the Canadians, you better not do this or we're going to cut off trade with Canada. Well, that's nonsense, of course. I mean, nobody believes that, we're going to cut off trade with Canada if they liberalize marijuana laws. It's just not going to happen. It's too much, the trade is too important. So, I don't think the Canadians are particularly worried about it, and it's clear that they are moving toward full decriminalization, and they have already initiated steps to make medical marijuana broadly available.
Right. Seems a lot of hope up there.
Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. You know, getting back to what the other caller just before was saying, you know, it looks hopeless from time to time. Look at it from the other side. Look at it from their side. How would you like to be in the position of John Ashcroft trying to stop this? I mean, it's clearly a tidal wave, global tidal wave, against U.S. policy because these other countries have had, you know, years under our thumb. We demanded that they institute prohibition back in 1914 and ban marijuana for prohibition. We began it in 1937, and we made every other country. People were kicking and screaming. Nobody wanted to go along with us on this. Practically, well, Egypt did for some reason. I don't know. But anyhow, the British didn't, the Dutch didn't, nobody wanted to, and we forced them all to it. Now they're saying, well, like, look where it's got us. I mean, we got, you know, like machine gun fights in the streets. The hell with this. We're going to go the other way. And the Dutch have shown the path for everyone. They've got a much more sane approach to it, and it's working wonders over there. The use of marijuana among Dutch children is half that of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, of course, we suspect there are other motives besides altruism in our leaders for this drug war, and they could still pull the militaristic fascist move and just, pull the rug out from under us that way. But hopefully we'll stop it before it gets that far.
Let's hope. John, it's always good to hear from you. I do have a couple more calls in just a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go. Where are we at? We got Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Good evening, Brian. Do you have a question for Mike Gray?
Yes, I do. I also want to say, Dean, thank you for calling in on a bunch of the other shows that KPFD does. I've been hearing you throughout the day, throughout the week, and I'm glad to hear your voice on other issues as well.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask Mike about what his opinion of the new commercial wave we see on TV with, if you buy drugs, you're supporting terrorism, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And I've heard your views, and I was just kind of curious what Mike's views on that. And is, you know, it's obvious that that's part of the new wave of, you know, taking charge of the new drug war, I guess. And
well, of course, I don't think anybody pays any attention to those ads. They're ridiculous. And some people, I'm sure, who are already opposed to, any sort of rational drug policy would find those ads charming and whatnot. But the truth is the actual measurements that were conducted over the last year, not about those ads specifically, but about the ad campaign conducted by the office, White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Congress finally mandated, they said, we don't know if we're pouring money down a rat hole in this ad campaign. We demand some kind of a survey to find out if we're making any headway with these ads. Well, they found out that not only were the ads not having any positive impact, that for some reason among white suburban females, young white suburban females, the ad campaign from the White House was making them more curious about drugs, not less. So, that not only do they not know what they're doing, but they're actually being harmful to the youth of America at the same time with our tax dollars.
Right.
Stunning.
Now I also heard briefly, and I didn't hear much about it, now wasn't there like a counter ad or a similar ad to theirs? I think Susan Sarandon was involved in it and so on, and I didn't really get to hear much about it, and I was wondering if you guys knew any more about that.
Well, there was an ad campaign that was run by Arianna Huffington, the columnist who basically turned that government campaign on its head and said, if you're driving an SUV, you're contributing to terrorism because you're using up gas and oil,
Right.
Making us more dependent upon the Middle East. So, it was meant to be a tongue-in-cheek, but people took it seriously and began debating it, Are we really helping terrorism? Well, the truth is, you are, of course. I mean, if we weren't dependent on Middle East oil, we wouldn't be over there right now.
Now, but didn't that whole ad campaign get, nixed the first, 12 hours it was aired or something?
I mean, they didn't put very much energy behind it. I think, didn't that debut during the Super Bowl?
Right, $2 million a pop, if I don't...
Yeah, right, $2 million ad.
Yeah.
And that was the only one, then, in other words.
I think that was the only one like that. They've got others in the campaign. Let me say one thing. I'm all for advertising, an advertising campaign, an intelligent advertising campaign, speaking to young people that would encourage temperance, and would encourage them to stay away from drugs. That has been proven to be tremendously successful right here in California with tobacco. Okay?
Right.
In other words, they added a tax to tobacco here in California, and you can imagine the howling from the tobacco companies, but anyhow, the tax was to produce an anti-smoking ad campaign, which they ran, and it caused a 40% drop in teenage tobacco use here in California over the course of that advertising campaign. Now, that is a successful drug prevention program. It has nothing to do with cops and robbers or midnight ninja busts or ripping stuff out of people's hands and putting a knee in their back. It was a straightforward, intelligent, educational campaign based on facts, speaking to the youth in their language, and it was enormously successful.
Great.
Well, I don't know. We're about to wrap up here. Brian, I sure appreciate your call. Give us a call here in 2 weeks. Mike, we're going to have to wrap it up. We just couldn't get around everything. You are is it the chairman of the Common Sense for Drug Policy?
Yeah, right.
And, there's so much there we should have gotten to. I'm so sorry. We just don't have time. Mike, let me turn you loose here. What do you want to tell my audience and, how can they reach you or so forth?
Well, I think this is a moment where we really need to marshal our resources. We need to be able to coordinate our efforts so that when a particular piece of legislation or something is being considered, we can get hundreds of letters and thousands of letters. Richard Lake has done a wonderful job in stimulating that kind of work, but we really need to reach out to other organizations. And anybody who's interested in getting deeper into this, You can log on to our website. Common Sense for Drug Policy is a service organization. We're not looking for members or anything. It's, well, what we exist strictly to, as you were saying, we're enablers. We make it possible for other organizations to get access to resources. And we have a website, www.csdp.org. Common Sense for Drug Policy, csdp.org. And there's an organizer's toolkit on there. If you're interested in figuring out how to start an organization, they can teach you from step one, the material there from, you know, a lot of experts all over, and connections to MAP Inc. and other resources, including the federal government resources. The Drug Enforcement Administration, the website is accessible through there, and so you can get all sides of the argument.
Drug War Facts?
Drug War Facts are excellent publication. Wonderful. Put together by Doug McVeigh and updated almost, I think, several times a week. And that has become a tremendous resource for journalists all over the country. Anybody who wants a copy of that, you can access it electronically on that website, csdp.org. But you can also get a hard copy. I think you just have to write in and ask for it, I believe.
Mike, that's going to have to about do it for tonight, sir. I thank you so much. Let's do this again. I hope to see you in San Francisco. And... you know, you're just great. I thank you so much.
Dean, thank you. I'm looking forward. I'll, you can buy me a drink in San Francisco, okay?
All right, sir.
All right,
okay.
Wonderful.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Steve's got the Activist Corner, and I want to remind you, the 420 Fest coming up April 20th is produced by Houston Music Alliance and Graphics Productions.
All right, Dean, we got a couple of things coming up. For those guys in Austin that are listening on the Internet, we hit Austin Normal will be having their monthly meeting at the Crown and Anchor. That's going to be at 5 p.m. this Sunday on the 30th. Coming up on April 8th at 7 p.m., Houston Normal and DPFT will be having a joint monthly meeting at the Emerson Unitarian Church. We're going to have a special guest, Nora Callahan. She's going to be the guest speaker. She's with the November Coalition and also a part of the Journey for Justice. And as Dean was saying, we have the 420 Festival coming up on April 20th from 3 to midnight. One thing, we got a special note up here in the control room that they want us to give out the numbers for the Capitol switchboard so you can voice your comments to your elected representatives and let them know what you think about the drug war. That's 1-800-839-5276. And the White House comment line is 202-456-1111. If you don't like what's happening with the drug war, call your elected representatives and let them know they need to change the policy on there. That's about it for the Activist Corner, Dean.
All right, Steve, thank you so much. We're just about done here. I wanted to read you a couple of quotes from some late-night comedians. Good news for Iraq, there's a 50% chance that President Bush will confuse it with Iran. The Pentagon still has not given a name to the Iraqi war. Somehow Operation Reelect Bush just doesn't seem popular. Well, friends, that's about it. Tune in this time next week. You'll hear The Other Side with Glenn Urbach, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with somebody that will just knock your socks off. Thank you. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth.